Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, and our producer this morning is Patricia Kohlberg. This is the 35th year the Old Mole has been on the air, 35 years of our strong support for this community-powered radio station, 35 years in which KBOO has been crucial in building and sustaining community in the Portland region. KBOO is a big part of what's made this area unique in the country, both politically and culturally. I'm glad you're listening. I hope you, like we on the Old Mole, are supporters of the station. You can join our spring membership drive by donating in at least four different ways. Ready to take notes? Go to kboo.fm/give. Click on the red donate button in the KBOO mobile app. Text KBOO to 44321. And finally, thinking of the more limited possibilities that were available 35 years ago when the Old Mole joined KBOO, mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. The Old Mole airs Monday mornings, so today is as close as we get this year to a May Day program. I'd like to start, therefore, with a Portland May Day story that has some bearing on one of our pieces later in the show. The year was 2000. There had been no May Day celebration in Portland for decades, and city officials were determined to keep it that way. The mayor had brought in a brutal police chief out of Los Angeles, known for disciplining children with a boat oar. Under his command, the police department was newly stocked with military equipment. It was barely 5 months since hundreds of Oregonians had participated in the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, KBOO having played a major role in mobilizing the folks who went. From nearly the beginning, police attacked our May Day march. Their version of what happened was different, of course, claiming they were the victims. But after a few days of distorted media coverage, footage from news helicopters overhead ended up giving the lie to the mayor's and the police account. There were community meetings, the police chief was forced to resign, and next year, when we claimed the right to march and refused to ask for permission, the city council stepped in and paid for a march permit. With the police restrained, our 2001 march was peaceful and very impressive, numbering in the thousands. But the story I want to tell took place in that first march, back in 2000. The police attacked in military formation, on foot, bikes, and with horses, on the downtown streets and along the waterfront. Marchers were trapped, bloodied, and dispersed. With a small group, including my 13-year-old son and his friend, I ended up on the north side of Burnside near Powell's. Facing us, across the street, was a phalanx of masked and armored police. Just as they started toward us, a large group of brawny men came up behind them. It was the ILWU, leaders of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, 400 of them from up and down the West Coast. They were in Portland at a union hotel for their annual convention. In a loud voice, so we could hear it from across the street, Brian McWilliams, president of the union, said two things. He reminded the police that they wouldn't have a union of their own here in Portland if not for the support of the longshore workers. Which is true. The ILWU had shut down the port to force the city to recognize the Portland Police Association. And, he said, the cops had 1 minute, then the ILWU was coming through. Before the minute was up, the police had slunk away. The ILWU had rescued May Day. Later in the program, we'll hear about another facet of this politicized union, a new novel called Presente, a Dockworker Story, by Herb Mills, about when the ILWU refused to load armaments being shipped to a brutal Central American dictatorship. Before then, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker are left in the law moles, look at campus protest and the students' campaign at Portland State University to cut the university's ties with Boeing. Bookmole Matt Witt gives us his very thoughtful take on In the Pines by Grace Elizabeth Hale, another new book that challenges the stories we tell about ourselves, the justifications we create for ourselves. To begin, Bill Resnick speaks with Larry Kleinman on what Bill calls the contradictions of immigration. Larry was one of the founders and officers of PECUN, Oregon's farm worker union. And to introduce Bill and Larry, I turn the mic over to Joan Baez, singing a Woody Guthrie song about migrant workers.
The crops are all in, and the peaches are rotting. The oranges are piled, and the creosote dumps. And they're flying back to the Mexican border to pay all their money and way back again.
Larry Kleinman, welcome again to KABU.
Great to be here with you, Bill.
Larry Kleinman co-founded with Cipriano Farrell and joined by Roman Ramirez to lead the organization PECUN, Pineros y Caminos. Do the proper Spanish, Larry.
It's Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, but commonly known as PECUN because of by our initials.
And Pineros are tree planters. Yeah. PECUN in its 45 years in Woodburn, Oregon, had many successes, became a formidable farm worker union, won several strikes for higher pay, safety measures, also sponsored for and fought for and won legislation regarding farm worker housing, work safety, pesticide control, won eligibility for driver's license for undocumented people, and made Oregon a sanctuary state, the first state in the nation to pass a statewide law stopping state and local police and government from helping federal authorities with immigration enforcement. In addition, PECUN played an important role in winning the ballot initiative that increased Oregon's minimum wage, that importantly had a yearly cost of living adjustment. And as it grew, PECUN added a radio station and built affordable housing for farm workers and the immigrant community. Through those years, Larry Kleinman was Secretary Treasurer of PECUN, was also delegated to represent PECUN in the Fair Immigration Reform Movement, known as FIRM, the National Lobby for Immigrant Rights. And in 2013, Larry stepped down from day-to-day responsibilities as Secretary Treasurer, that part of a successful transition to a new generation of PECUN leadership, with whom he still closely consults. So, Larry, you've been organizing in Oregon for close to 50 years, and you've been deeply involved in the national level for 10, contributing to build a formidable political organization at the national level and developing national immigration policy for the immigration struggle. You've also, not least, watched and worked with people and families. Now, three generations of immigrants, many came here right from the fields with no formal education. You watch them become accomplished workers, political actors, and parents, bringing up a new generation of Latino activists. So, Larry, let's start with the basics, the numbers, who they are here and nationally, talk about why they came, compare them to their demonization in politics, why they risked a lot to come, and how they managed to stay and start new lives. So, Larry, give us the numbers and why they came and cartelization and who they are.
The first thing I'd like to start with, Bill, is that the patterns, broadly speaking, of immigration that we see today are, and I've seen throughout my adult life, strike me as fundamentally no different than the ones that were seen by in my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation. My mother's parents came here exactly 100 years ago from Ukraine at the close of wave of Eastern European immigration. They were workers. They spoke no English. They were from a persecuted ethnic group, in this case, Jews. And they repeated an experience that many before them have and many after them have, which is arriving here, getting themselves settled, getting involved in community organizations, in unions, bringing up family, who's the next generation gaining greater education, generally upward mobility. And that's fundamentally the characteristics we've seen of the waves of immigration in my lifetime. The one big difference that I want to point out is that the immigrants that I've worked with my whole adult life have overwhelmingly been from Latin America. They are not considered not white in this country, regardless of their of the color of their skin, and faced intractable discrimination, many barriers visible and intangible, things that my grandparents didn't face, although they did face some religious persecution. But they were accepted as white people, and that there were many barriers that they did not face as a result. So that's a huge distinction, and I never want to lose sight of that. But I think we also sometimes think of today's immigration as being completely different somehow, and I just don't buy that idea. Similarly, the kinds of organizations we've sought to create in the Pekun movement are very similar to the ones that were created in the 30s and in the 40s. My own grandparents were among the first residents of the first public housing in the city of Chicago and joined the Resident Association, were active in their community. That's exactly what Pekun has created with affordable housing through Farmworker Housing Development Corporation, one of our sister organizations. So many of the ideas of immigrant organizing and labor organizing are not new either, but they are in a new condition and in a new environment. A brief word about Woodburn and Oregon. When I got to Woodburn in 1978, there were 60,000 Latinos in the state. And today there are 600,000 Latinos. That's a tenfold increase at a time when the population of the state over those same 45 plus years was less than 100% increase. So there are now large Latino communities almost everywhere in this state, from small towns to big cities. Woodburn has always been sort of at the forefront, the vanguard demographically, in that it was one of the first cities of size, of any size, to have a Latino or Mexican majority. And that was in officially in the year 2000, though it was probably earlier. The school district here is 80% Latino. So the critical mass is evident. And just as you said, I have known many families, known the first generation, the second generation, now the third. And you see those patterns again replicated of children having educational opportunities, going to college, getting into business or profession, or coming back to the community and leading, as is the case in Pekun. My successor was exactly one of those younger people. He's now 40, but he came to this country as a small kid and went to college. Adelmon Ramirez's successor, he was president with me as secretary treasurer for many years, was also grew up in Salem, a daughter of farm workers, went to college, is leading the movement now. So it's very gratifying to see that carried on with new ideas, new energy, new relevancy, but the same fundamental principles and mission. Lastly, let me just say the situation that we deal with today that drives immigration is, I think, different than in other times, in that it includes a key element of the effects of climate change. And I don't think that was a big element driving immigration in other periods, but we continue to see immigration driven by violence. Today, a level of cartel-generated violence that's, I think, unprecedented, as opposed to civil war or government violence, which also continue in places, and crushing economics, the crushing economics of the working class in other countries, often tied back to U.S. foreign policy and economic policy. Those crushing economics are a driver of immigration. So again, those to me are the big factors. The one thing that I think is incredibly striking when we think about the immigration through the southern border in 2012, so 12 years ago, the composition of folks crossing the border was 75% Mexican. In 2022, it was 25% Mexican and a much larger flow at that. So it was probably around a little under 3 million and only 25% Mexican, meaning Central American, but also large numbers of Asian folks Africans, Europeans included. So it's a very different mix of folks than we have seen in recent times. And about 6 million people have arrived in the last 3 years, many claiming asylum, fleeing climate change, cartel violence, and the crushing economics of their home countries.
Yeah, let's get to the that 2 million people who are coming every year. It's in fact led to 1 million of them becoming able to enter the country, get jobs, even though they're undocumented, get jobs and start building communities. It seems to me right now also in-migration is getting greater. They're coming to a country where many of them have either people from their communities that they know or, in fact, relatives and friends that have preceded them. And sometimes they come into this country expecting and anticipating getting a job working alongside of one of their friends or in the companies of previous immigrants. Is that accurate?
So I think that does describe many people, but there's also large numbers of folks who are arriving with no connections. This is particularly true in the Venezuelan community, I would say. 1 million Venezuelans have entered the United States in the last 3 years, and many of them did not come from Venezuela. They came from Colombia or Ecuador, where they had been attempting to make a life in exile and came to find that untenable. But what is the case, I think, maybe one way in which I think that pattern you describe is common, is that the wherewithal to make the trek north to get to the northern border of Mexico, southern border of the U.S., is almost completely controlled by cartels now. Human trafficking is a $10 billion industry, thoroughly controlled by them. It's very expensive and very dangerous. And the expense part of it means selling everything you have, if you have anything, or going into debt, which is very dangerous with a criminal organization, and or borrowing money from relatives or close friends that are in the U.S. that can send that. And that's how this whole economy is financed. We've seen, for example, 500,000 people transit through the Darien Gap, a dense jungle with no roads in northern Colombia and southern Panama in the last year, which is completely, it blows my mind to think that that's what the immigration flow consists of, or part of what it consists of. We've seen 7,500 immigrants from Mauritania in West Africa transiting up to the northern border of Mexico through Nicaragua, because Nicaragua has dropped all of its visa requirements for various countries and is actually charging fees for folks that transit through Nicaragua. That's how folks from other continents, as one of the routes, folks from Africa, from Asia, from other parts of Latin America, get that far north or across the ocean in order to then go over land. So this huge procession of folks, which is aided and abetted by the cartels, is driven by those three forces I mentioned, but also, as you correctly say, by the need for labor in this country. And I've read more than one analysis now that points out that had there not been the arrival of several million workers in the last 3 years, that this country would have gone into recession, and instead it has not. And economists are now largely crediting the arrival of immigrant workers. Not surprising to those of us that watch the demographics of this, because you're not building anything in this country. You're not taking care of people if you don't have workers. And the workers doing that work are immigrant workers.
This is happening. The 1 million people per year that the U.S. is absorbing, many of them children, of course, but it's all of the adults try to get jobs and do, in fact, perhaps leaving one woman to take care of the kids of many families. That's despite an effort to stop them. You know, we hear a lot about ICE and the Trump administration in particular, efforts to round people up, deport them, an effort to force businesses to check the documentation, citizen documentation of all new workers or perhaps old workers too. Why hasn't it worked, any of the efforts that are made? And Trump is sort of trying to or at least demonizing the people. I don't think he's going to even try and round up people except as a maybe a symbolic measure to show that he's a tough guy and doesn't, you know, and is going to round up those immigrants. Tell us why all that failed.
The Trump effect has been more impactful politically than logistically, as you correctly point out. As many an observer has said, show me a 50-foot wall and I'll show you a 52-foot ladder. and when you have a $10 billion industry dedicated to human trafficking with great capacities and ability to bribe local officials, and you have a 2,000-mile border with all kinds of terrain, including ports of entry that remain open for millions of crossings every year, commercial and human, you know, the idea that you're going to build a wall or any other one measure is going to stop that is just fanciful. And of course, it's largely for rhetorical demagoguery, not for practicality. There is, however, a really marked difference between how, even as feeble as the Trump administration's efforts were relative to Trump's rhetoric and the aspirations of the anti-immigrant team that he brought into the White House, led by Stephen Miller, even as impactful as that was, we've seen a marked change during the Biden administration. And let me just say that what gets a lot of attention, and you know, understandably so, in the immigration space is what's happening at the border. It is, and it deserves attention. There's a major movement of people. The question of whether that's a movement of people that is beneficial or is harmful or maybe a combination is the debate. But let me just put it this way to you, Bill. Of all of the undocumented immigrants who were in this country when Biden took office more than 3 years ago, 99% of them are still here, leaving aside, of course, those who died or those who left truly on their own. And there were obviously many thousands of those folks. So leaving them aside, who since 3 years ago have died or left on their own, 99% of the folks are still here. Because deportations from the interior of the country during the Biden administration have averaged 30,000 a year. That's 90,000 immigrants over 3 years as a proportion of 11 million undocumented folks. So that's less than 1%, right? During the Trump administration, it was 80,000 a year. So it was much higher. The Biden administration has all but curtailed workplace raids. And if you live in a blue state where most immigrants live, now, Florida and Texas are an exception here, but if you live in a blue state or even in a blue city in a red state, but certainly in the blue states, you have access to a driver's license, and there is some form of disentanglement between local police and ICE, either expressed in statute or in policy. In many of these states, it is in statute. And so there is the practical effect of what I call protection. And there are two things that are the deep aspirations of our movement, which is permanence and protection. Permanence is a matter we need Congress to act on. There's no way around that I know of, unless the Supreme Court wants to allow Texas to make its own immigration laws and then allow California to do the same in the opposite direction. I have a feeling they're not going to do that, but that would be the only way in which what I'm saying wouldn't be the case. So we can only win permanence through Congress, full stop. There's just no other path. But we can win protection or de facto protection in a lot of ways. And I would argue to you, Bill, that today, in the last 3 years under the Biden administration, we have had 99%+ protection of the undocumented population in this country.
Well, that's a plus mark for Biden. His support of Israel is an enormous minus. Larry, thanks so much for talking to us today, and we'll talk to you soon about the whole set of interesting issues in the future of America and its immigrants. It seems to me a challenge for the left, and how do we deal with climate change? All those issues are open. Larry Kleinman has lots of experience in working on them. Thanks for talking to us today.
Appreciate the invitation, Bill. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thanks, Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman. You'll hear Patricia again later on in a brief radio drama from the novel Presente, a dock worker story. Here she has something to say about your favorite community radio station.
KBOO has been on the air for more than half a century, giving voice to the many diverse communities in Portland and bringing you views, reviews, and interviews on the issues you care about. If you like what you hear, please support KBOO, your volunteer-powered community radio station. To contribute, go to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321.
And now, a special treat. Two of them, actually. Bob Dylan joins Joan Baez in another version of that Woody Guthrie song, Deportee, followed by Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with Left and the Law on Campus Protest.
Goodbye to my walk, goodbye, Rosalita, adios, mis amigos, Jesus y Maria, you won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, all of you.
For years now, activist student groups have pressured their administrations to divest from weapons manufacturers and defense contractors, many as part of the BDS campaign, or Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions campaign against Israel. In 2016, the Associated Students of Portland State University passed a resolution calling on PSU to divest from any institutions that profit from human rights violations against Palestinians. In 2021, ASPSU passed a new resolution calling on the PSU administration to cut ties with Boeing specifically. Pressure on the administration has intensified in recent months, with student groups shutting down a PSU board meeting on January 6th to press their demands. I was at the board meeting and also attended the event on April 22nd when a faculty and student group presented a petition to President Ann Cudd, signed by over 1,200 faculty and staff, students, and community members protesting disciplinary actions taken against student organizers for disrupting the meeting. So, Mike, as a legal scholar and attorney, what is your assessment of the case that the students have against Boeing and their calls for the university to cut ties with the company?
Well, Boeing is a chief supplier to Israel of jet planes, of bombs, of helicopters, of a whole variety of military weapons. You know, Boeing is generally known for making passenger planes. But as we all know, anybody who ever travels, their planes are not as reliable as they once were. You know, Boeing has a reputation of a civilian airplane maker, but their profits have been at least half based on defense work. Defense in the, it's a ludicrous word for what they do. It's all really ways of blowing things up and blowing people up. But that's now become, with the collapse of their civilian plane sales, a really important part. In fact, it supplies, according to their quarterly report yesterday, more than two-thirds of their profits. And Boeing has just moved. They moved from Seattle to Chicago for financial reasons, but now they've moved to Arlington, Virginia, where they have $13 million a year budgeted for lobbying, and they're essentially becoming a government defense contractor. They're losing out to Airbus on passenger sales. So Boeing has been a direct beneficiary of recent huge increases in money supplied to Israel for war making. In fact, Israel is required to spend their money with American manufacturers, Boeing being a leading one, who supply them with their bombs and their tracking devices and every other piece of equipment they use militarily.
President Cudd has several arguments in defense of the university's ties with Boeing, which amount to accepting contributions from Boeing for student scholarships. There's a room in the business school apparently named for Boeing in honor of their contributions, and that the university has no direct investments in Boeing, and Boeing does not produce weapons or defense-related contracts here in Oregon. They make apparently commercial airplane parts. So what would be your response to those grounds for defending PSU's continued relationship with Boeing?
Well, her grounds are hyper-technical. The basic reason for divesting from Boeing and cutting all contacts with Boeing is Boeing's active participation and profiting from genocide. That's what's happening. Now, students have yet to develop financial interests in the world, and therefore they can see clearly what's going on, that every day men, women, and children are being blown apart. Schools, cemeteries are being blown apart with Boeing-used weapons. They are coming from a moral place. President Cudd has some interests in that Boeing gives a trivial amount of money for scholarships. But I think the whole point of divesting means to completely cut contact with Boeing. It should not be hard because it's not extensive. There are some traditional connections with Boeing, but they're not really important to the university. And if the university is going to take any sort of moral stance about the most dramatic, systematic slaughter of civilians that has happened in decades anywhere in the world, then they should divest.
You know, one of the faculty members who spoke when the group presented their petition and complaint at the president's office, she wasn't there, was presented to her assistant, was that PSU proudly proclaims its role as a global community member promoting justice and enlightened practices around the world. And there seems to be a perverse irony in its support, in Boeing's support for their global supply chain program. You can get a bachelor's or a master's degree in business at PSU in global supply chain management. And Boeing is itself very proud of their being a community partner, making the world a better place. And of course, if you follow that global supply chain very far, it takes you to really dark places. So it's not as though the program emphasizes, you know, better reclining seats in their commercial airplanes or more secure doors. They are specifically supporting a global supply chain management program.
Well, what that does, it arranges something that's very tricky and hard to do, and that is transfer a 2,000-pound bomb from place A to place B when you've got to cross land, cross oceans, and get it. The whole process of supply distributing these supplies is indeed intricate, but it's, and in fact, it's essential toward making war and toward killing men, women, and children in Gaza, is arranging how you do this complex process of manufacturing and then distributing successfully and getting to the right place these bombs. Distribution, supply chain distribution, it's an essential part of war making, of killing.
So before we close today with, I think, are recognizing the courage and the persistence and the resilience of so many student activists here at Portland State, specifically Super Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, but campus groups, Jewish Voice for Peace, and many others around the country who are being arrested for occupying places, peaceful occupation on their campuses. Before closing, what's your take on the legal risks students are facing who, in many cases, do choose to be arrested to make a statement as a political strategy? And that's part of the organizing and intentional planning of some of these actions, although others involve the precipitous call for policing, as in Colombia, where the president called in the NYPD and roughed up students and arrested them. So sometimes they're part of a of an intentional plan for civil disobedience, sometimes not.
Well, Jan, it's a classic confrontation. Students see clearly because they have no financial or political interests in what's going on, and they see an atrocious, systematic slaughter of people. Now, their superiors, those who contribute to the universities, who run the universities, who rely on the universities for employees, they've been dealing with Israel directly and indirectly for decades now, and they have a sort of a set view of what's going on. They cannot see that that set view has been qualitatively changed by what's happened over the last few months. So there's square confrontation. They're trying to suppress the students who are trying to get the clear sense of morality out, their vision out there, their description simply of the facts of what's going on. Who's bombing who? Who's killing who? Who's dying? And that means there are going to be First Amendment conflicts, and they will continue to occur. The borderline between expression and agitation is always a disputed one, and there's going to be disputes. They will vary from case to case. In Columbia, where they invited the New York Police Department in to arrest students who had paid tens of thousands of dollars to be on that campus, who give that campus its life, is an atrocious move that will reverberate for months ahead.
They were arrested. Many were arrested for trespassing. It reminds me of indigenous groups who have called out the obscene irony of being trespassing on lands that indigenous people have claims to. So there's always that issue of trespassing. Who owns the land? Oh, okay, Mike. Well, we will continue to follow the protests, and we hope they can continue to build and make a difference, because it's certainly inspiring as well as appalling and sad and horrifying what's happening in Gaza and occupied territories.
And let's hope Portland State is successful, and the students are successful in cutting all contacts, all dependence, all connections with Boeing Incorporated.
Yes.
Thanks to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, who regularly appear on this program to address issues related to the law from a left perspective. I mentioned that this is the Old Mole's 35th year on KABU. Before the pandemic, we would raise funds for this station in a bit of a different manner. Our program, like all the others, would be interrupted every few minutes by wonderful volunteers who would make a pitch and ask for donors to call their commitments into the station. They would often say something like, "The Old Mole brings you information you can't get anywhere else." And I would protest on the air. It's not so much information we offer, though we certainly do some of that, but perspective, like you just heard with our Left in the Law. Not only reporting on activist efforts, but critical engagement toward what can actually work and what is simply spinning our wheels. That is what KBOO offers. To keep us on the air, please donate if you're able. Go to kboo.fm/give, click on the red donate box in the KABU mobile app, text KABU to 44321, or mail a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you. And now, book mole Matt Witt found that a thoughtful new book, In the Pines, by Grace Elizabeth Hale, prompted some further reflections of his own. Matt?
The nonfiction book In the Pines by Grace Elizabeth Hale begins with a story worthy of the most dramatic novel. Hale, who is white and is now a history professor, grew up in the Atlanta suburbs, but in the summers she would visit her grandparents who lived in a poor rural county in Mississippi. She adored her grandfather, a retired county sheriff, and spent many happy hours with him, fishing for catfish, berry picking, and horseback riding. When Hale was a college student, her mother told her about something heroic her grandfather did in the 1940s when he was sheriff. It seems her grandfather arrested a black man who was accused of rape by a white woman. As was common in the South, a crowd of white men gathered at the county jail, demanding that the sheriff turn the black prisoner over to them for a lynching. Hale's grandfather refused to do so, bravely standing up to the mob, even though it might cost him his job at the next election. Unfortunately, Hale's mother went on, some of the sheriff's underlings waited until he wasn't there and took the black man out to the woods, where he tried to escape being lynched and was shot to death. Years later, after Hale's grandfather had died, Hale went to Mississippi to visit her grandmother. While there, she reviewed the archives of the local newspaper and found a very different account of what had happened to that black man and of the role her grandfather played. But neither her mother's story nor the newspaper account felt like it was the truth, and Hale began to apply her meticulous historian skills to dig deeper. I won't spoil the book by telling you what she found out, but I can say that In the Pines is quite unusual in that the author leaves no stone unturned, even if it reflects badly on her own family. While uncovering the truth, Hale also tells the history of a poor section of the South, how it has evolved over the years, and how black people there managed to create community despite a racist and often violent power structure. She also points out that whether to participate in the system's worst excesses was a choice for white people, and that not all of them did so. Reading In the Pines, I thought about how many of us tell flattering stories about ourselves or family members, and how we stood up to injustice even while others around us did not, stories that also might not hold up to examination by an objective historian. As Hale and her readers look back at racist Mississippi and wonder, how could otherwise decent people go along with the atrocities being committed around them? I think about us today. Like Hale, will future generations look back at injustices we tolerate or participate in? Like the killing of 30,000 people in Gaza with U.S. military supplies, and the displacement and starving of nearly 2 million more, and wonder, back in 2024, what could Americans who were paying for that kind of genocide possibly have been thinking?
Thanks, Matt Witt, one of our well-read book moles. At the start of today's program, I told a story about the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Now we have another. In 1980, acting in solidarity with freedom fighters in Central America, the ILWU successfully refused to load military supplies being shipped from the U.S. government to El Salvador's dictatorship. One of the key organizers in that campaign has written a remarkable novel about the union's action. To put us in the right frame of mind to hear about Presente, a dock worker story by Herb Mills, here's one of my favorite Oregon groups, Monday Morning Denial, from Eugene, singing Harry Bridges.
Harry helped to build the bridges that the workers marched across in a time when it was dangerous to agitate the boss. When the workers got together to see what they could do, they built a solid union, the ILWU.
A recent theater festival here in Portland presented a number of productions of new plays with a focus I haven't seen in a while. The focus was on work and people at work coping with difficult conditions on their jobs. Pay cuts, speed up, sexual harassment, safety, union organization, all were explored for their dramatic potential in workers' lives. The real-life upsurge in worker activism clearly is finding its echo in the cultural milieu. That's a good thing. It doesn't, however, mean that the cultural expressions get it right. authors who haven't themselves had the experience they write about can easily fall into misleading stereotypes about work or about unions. One of the plays was about a real historical episode, one I happen to have written about and know well, and it simply got a lot of its facts wrong. With each significant mistake, you could see the playwright making uninformed assumptions about worker behavior and about what unions are and what they do. Assumptions, maybe from conventional media, that are very far from what actually happened in the real history. And it's not as if what actually happened was any less dramatic than the playwright's misinformation. Sympathy for workers is good, but accurate understanding of workplace conditions and how workers do and can respond takes us well beyond an altruistic sympathy to the possibility of allyship, of joining together in struggle. Which brings me to a novel I want to recommend. It's called Presente, a Dockworker Story, and is published by Hardball Press. Its author, Herb Mills, worked on the docks in San Francisco, then held elected positions within the Dockworker Union, the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Presente, as you know, is what we say at memorial services to express that the person who died is still present, still with us in spirit. The novel takes us back to a horrific time in Central America when people were dying by the thousands because they were trying to free their country from domination by U.S. capital, because they wanted real democracy instead of rigged elections, or because they worked on small parcels of land that their wealthy neighbors coveted. A time, come to think of it, not so very different from our own time now. A time when the ILWU took a stand, refusing to load a shipment of military supplies being sent from the U.S. government to the bloody dictatorship in El Salvador. Presente, a Dockworker's Story, is about that refusal, that stirring act of solidarity with the struggle of people in another country. The ILWU was formed out of a West Coast-wide strike that began in 1934, 90 years ago next week. I've talked on the Old Mole about taking people to see the bullet holes in Pier Park trees that were mementos of a police attack on strikers in that time. The new union was, and continues to be, more democratic than most others, and more aware of its role in world commerce and world struggles. In 1935, while it was still forming, the union refused to load arms going to Mussolini when fascist Italy decided it wanted colonies like the other European powers and invaded Ethiopia. 2 years before 1980, the time in which the novel is set, the union blocked the shipment of bomb parts to the Pinochet regime in Chile. In 1980, along with its refusal connected to El Salvador, the ILWU let it be known that it would block cargo to South Korea if the dictatorship there went ahead with its planned hanging of a leading democratic opposition figure. At the last minute, that execution was canceled. Earlier that same year, when Archbishop Oscar Romero of San Salvador was assassinated in his church by the regime's death squads, the union had joined solidarity groups in expressing outrage. Now, having discovered a secret shipment and having traced it to the U.S. Department of Defense, it was in a position to act. So this is a novel about organizing. The union contract at the time forbids work shutdowns for political reasons. The union could be fined, its officers even jailed. But if public opinion could be swung behind it, if the Central America Solidarity Movement could be enlisted, if religious groups could be mobilized, the shipping bosses and the U.S. government would be forced to back down. The organizing is about building power, and the novel shows us day by day how that happens, how in real life it happened. Because the author, Herb Mills, was a union steward at the time and integral to this struggle, the novel also lets us see the rest of his work, the day-by-day class struggle on the docks. Longshore work is unlike any other. When I worked in a steel mill, each of the jobs I had stayed the same day after day, unless something extraordinary happened, like an accident. On the docks that Mills describes, each ship presents different challenges. Each pier has a different boss with a different personality, a different way to try to bully workers into generating more profit. One ship lacks safety rails to protect workers from slipping overboard, but the boss dismisses worker concerns. On another pier, bosses try to force workers to load deadly chemicals with faulty equipment. Elsewhere, carbon monoxide levels are too high in the ship's hold, or mechanical loaders lack brakes, or the restrooms are filthy and dysfunctional. All of these require daily confrontations with the dock's petty dictators. And every Friday, there are problems with worker paychecks for the union steward to address. In the midst of these struggles, and probably because of them too, we get a sense of the camaraderie among the workers. In the novel, this comes with a bit of nostalgia, of regret, because the protagonist is now working for these dock workers as steward, not among them as he used to. In this passage, the character who stands in for Herb Mills has just briefed some of the workers whom the bosses will try to get to load the secret military supplies.
More dockers started to flood in as we ate, and pretty much everyone who came in knew at least one man sitting at my table. The tick-tock was a sea of smiles and shaking hands as people caught up and shot the breeze. As I looked on and admired the fellowship, I was struck with a flash of how this same scene had repeated over the years. I'd been coming to the tick-tock since I was a fresh-faced kid. Back then, nothing used to give me more joy than a laugh and a drink with a buddy from the dock. So many folks, back then and right here, had fashioned good lives for themselves, from their work, their companionship, their union bond. It brought a faint nostalgic smile to my face. But at the same time, it struck me that I didn't really feel like a part of this crowd anymore, more of an observer. I could clearly see my face laughing along with these men, but that face seemed like a ghost to me. I decided to dip out and head to the office. I said goodbye to my breakfast companions and wished them the best of luck in today's fight, then got into my car and pulled away.
Why write this already thrilling story in the form of a novel? One of the reasons undoubtedly is to enable a larger readership. As a novel, it has more than an element of romance. Here is our introduction to the photojournalist who'll be documenting the struggle. The steward has just verified the secret military supplies, using the unacceptable restrooms as a pretext to get into the warehouse where the supplies are being hidden. I knew the terminal bosses wouldn't be thrilled at the idea of Susan poking her media head around. So I explained that her cover story for McSweeney would be that she's investigating health and safety issues for OSHA.
Interesting cover. Any reason?
With that, I told her all about the, quote, powder room situation over on Pier 50 and how I'd used that to take a look at the shipment. The story made her bowl over laughing.
Do you often do such things?
Well, truth to tell, all the time.
So it's really a part of your job?
And part of the struggle. Honestly, to me, it's the easiest part.
Well, I hope to see some of it firsthand.
And see some of it she does, as their romance based in common values, political commitment, and a sense of humor begins to flourish. I've been talking about a genuine working-class novel where class struggle is part of the fabric of daily life, and with a lot to teach us about organizing for power. The novel is Presente, a Dockworker Story, by Herb Mills. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been reminiscing today about the Old Mole's 35 years on KABU. Years ago, I would introduce the program by saying something like, "This is a show for old moles like you and our studio visitors and interviewees and me, who continue to resist the powers that be. We old moles keep alive, in our actions as our thoughts, the assurance that something very much better is possible. On the Old Mole Variety Hour, we not only celebrate the myriad ways that people push for alternatives, we analyze them. Not all forms of resistance are effective, can actually change what exists. Celebration, vision, and analysis are themes for today and every week. That's still what I think the Old Mole stands for. Not everything we do lives up to this, but this is the Old Mole aspiration, as I see it. And what we do, what we attempt, is possible only through KABU. I hope you support the station. Again, go to kboo.fm/give, or click on the red donate box in the KABU mobile app. Text KBOO to 44321, or mail a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks to Old Moles, Patricia Kohlberg, Bill Resnick, John Hawken, Mike Snedeker, Matt Witt, guest Larry Kleinman, and the dedicated staff at KABU. We'll go out with a little more from Monday Morning Denial. As for you, stay safe and stay active.
Before the Union sailed against the flowing economic tide, the employer set the standards and then organized the right. Standards of human decency were easy to ignore, but all that changed in 1934. Here's to you, Harry May, your name forever stand for integrity.